Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Don't be slow. Cause I'm leaving in the morning.
All right, it's Dave Player on 720 WGN. So 52 years ago, the Monkees' Mickey Dolenz auditioned for a groundbreaking TV show that changed the face of music and television together. Mickey, Peter Tork, Michael Nesmith, and Davy Jones were cast in the madcap adventures of a rock band, but also gave us some of the greatest hits of our time. For its first season, the Monkees' TV show won the Emmy for Best Sitcom, and over the years have sold over 70 million albums with songs like Daydream Believer, Last Train to Clarksville, I'm a Believer, Steppin' Stone, and countless others. And on June 14th, the Monkees will present the Mike and Mickey Show at the Copernicus Center in Chicago, and to talk about the legacy of the Monkees is Mickey Dolenz. What's up, Mickey?
Wow, what an intro. You should introduce my show with me on the road.
I'd love to. Well, I mean, honestly,
thank you.
You're just somebody I have really grown up with and have been able to, you know, see you generationally since I was a kid. Like, I was thrilled to see you perform in 2011 with Peter and Davy. It was the 45th anniversary tour. It was my kids' first concert ever. And I got to tell you, yeah, it was their first concert ever. And I got to tell you, you sound better than ever, my friend.
Well, thank you. I work at it. I train. I try to take care of myself, and I work on keeping my voice in shape. You know, you have to when you do that many kind of concerts. I actually started a formal training kind of late in life when I started doing Broadway musicals, and you know, that's 8 shows a week,
and
some of them require a lot of big singing. And so touch wood. You know, my parents were also singers, and so I learned from them. And I think, frankly, a little bit of it for sure is genetic. You know, but I'm hanging in there.
Well, I was going to say, you came from genetically from a family of entertainers. Your mom and dad were both in the business.
Both singers, both actors. Yep, my mom played piano. My dad sang light opera, that kind of stuff. My mom was a big band singer and sang, you know, Billie Holiday bluesy, you know, kind of stuff too. And my sister and I, we grew up. My sister does the show with me; she'll be there.
Cool.
And we grew up absolutely in a showbiz family. It wasn't your typical sort of Hollywood Beverly Hills showbiz family. We lived out on a ranch with horses and chickens and
cool. And
stuff. And then I, as you probably know, I had that series when I was a kid called Circus Boy.
Yeah, that wasn't any local production. I mean, that series ran on NBC and ABC. That was a big deal.
Oh, it was a network show, yeah, like the Monkees. In fact, it was the exact same studio.
No way.
Yeah, absolutely. Screen Gems Television, it was called at the time. Now it's Sony TV. It was Screen Gems Television, and it was, as you say, NBC, and the same network that the Monkees showed on. And both of them took place almost exactly 10 years to the day. I went for an audition for Circus Boy when I was 10 years old at Screen Gems in Hollywood, and I went for the audition for the Monkees when I was 20 years old.
Wow.
And it would have been in the pilot season exactly 10 years later. In fact, when I drove up for the Monkee audition to the gate, the barred gate thing, the guy, the guard there at the gate said, "Hey, Mickey, you're coming back."
That's great.
He'd been the same guy that was there when I was doing
that's
Circus
fantastic. Work. That is awesome. Now, is that something, Mickey, that you wanted to do because you've seen your parents do it, or was it something they kind of pushed you into? Like, how did you get on the show? Like, what propelled you?
A good question. I was definitely not pushed into anything. I mean, I almost didn't even go to the Circus Boy audition because I had a baseball game. It was simply kind of following in my parents' footsteps, my father's footsteps, shall we say. But absolutely no pressure. My mom and dad, they were definitely not. My mom was definitely not a stage mom. You know, eyes and teeth, honey, eyes and teeth. I didn't have any training except watching my dad do it and my mom sing and my dad act, and but no stage school or anything like that. I just basically followed in my father's footsteps. You know, it was the family business. I got lucky, of course, with Circus Boy, but I'd already done a couple of screen tests even before that. So after Circus Boy, my parents took me out of the business very wisely, because those are the tricky years, you know, for a child star. You know, after you're big and famous, and then all of a sudden at 14 you're a has-been.
Yeah.
So they wisely took me out.
Very smart.
And back to school, back to regular school. And then after high school, I started to dabble. I'll tell you frankly, I went to college to be an architect.
Yeah, I read that. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to be an architect, and if I couldn't make it as an architect, I'd fall back on showbiz. And then
not a bad deal,
I was into architectural drafting for at least a year or so or more, and when the Monkey audition came along, and I wasn't a fool. I knew the power of a series, and of course, and but no, my plan was actually to be an architect.
But you were playing guitar a little bit early on too. I mean, but that was kind of a side thing. I mean, but you were focusing on.
Well, again, my family was
musical,
into music, and my father got me originally starting classical guitar, Segovia kind of stuff.
Great way to start.
And, yeah, I was 10, 11, you know, years old, and I was okay for a little kid. And then I would take my guitar when I started going to junior high, middle school, and then high school. I'd take my guitar to parties and play a little bit of, you know, Malaguena or something. And the girls would say, "Do you know any Kingston Trio?" And I said, "I'll be right back." Hang down your head. And that got me into folk music, of course, early 60s. That's what my generation was getting into. And then that morphed into rock and roll, and I started playing in cover bands, doing rock and roll stuff. And I talk about it a little bit in my solo show. I do mostly Monkey material, of course, but if I do something that's non-Monkey, I usually have a story. And for instance, I do Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry, and I tell the audience it's because that was my audition piece for
the Monkees. Right. And I'm thinking about this too, Mickey. So how did you get the call for that? Because I know there was eventually, 500 people that auditioned for this, but did they know you from Screen Gems? I mean, just like you said, the security guard, they knew who you were.
I didn't go to the cattle call. One doesn't go to the cattle call when one has had his own series.
Right. Yes, of course.
No, I had a private audition because, of course, I was, even though the Circus Boy had been, you know, a number of years earlier, I had done some, you know, kind of one-off guest starring things over the years in my teenage years, Mr. Novak and Peyton Place and some of those early, late 50s, early 60s television shows. So, no, I had an agent, you know, and so I went to a proper private audition, and then and it was extensive, those auditions. Boy, I'll never forget. It was way, way more extensive than a normal television series auditions, you know, where normally you'd go in and read, maybe get a call back and maybe have a screen test. But in this case, there was acting and singing and playing an instrument and improvisation and scene study. And, you know, they clearly had in mind that they wanted us to you had to be able to sing and play to get through even the first audition. You had to be able to do that. So clearly they had in mind that they were going to hopefully, if the thing went on the air and it did well, that we'd go on the road.
The local rock group down the street is trying to just came out to mow his lawn. Another Pleasant Valley Sunday. Charcoal burning everywhere.
All of you had musical backgrounds, but y'all played different things, and they kind of looked at you as, you know, playing what it looked like on screen rather than you actually knew how to play it. So how long did it take producers to actually allow you guys to play together?
Well, that's a real long story. You know, a couple of documentaries even been made about it. Yeah. No, when we were hired, as it were, they said, you're the drummer. I said, cool, where do I start? And I started to learn. They had already started recording stuff before they even hired us, because they had to for the production of the television show. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I wasn't that bothered one way or the other. I understood, you know, the business and Hollywood and television and stuff. Mike and Peter, especially Mike, I think were very... well, they've gone on record saying, Mike especially, he was very disappointed. You know, they had led him to believe, so he says, that he would be able to sing and write and record his own music. And the thing snowballed so quickly that I think it sort of got ripped out of everybody's hands, you know, at a very, very early age. And we had our palace revolt, as you may have heard, and we won the right to at least have something to say. We had nothing to say about the early recordings, not who was going to write them, who was going to sing them, who was going to play on them, which ones would be released.
Right.
You know, we didn't even have approval of album covers. That changed, you know, after the first two albums, which, by the way, I'm very proud of the first two albums. I mean, they're huge, and there was wonderful, wonderful material written by the likes of Voice and Heart and Carole King and Neil Diamond and, you know, huge, wonderful writers and great songs. And then the third album was Headquarters, which we decided to do entirely ourselves, and I'm really fond of that album, too. It's not a bad album at all. And that's just literally the four of us. I mean, we even did the catering.
Yeah. That's cool.
That first year, we sold more albums and singles than supposedly the Beatles and the Stones combined. But, the power of television and the show just resonated. But it isn't one thing. You know, people say, ask me, what was the secret of the success? And there is no secret. There's no formulas. If there were, there'd never be a flop. But you surround yourself with, you know, talented people and people that share your vision, and you work hard, and you hopefully avoid the pitfalls and the mistakes. And then, you know, the way I look at it is that one day, you know, the whole just becomes greater than the sum of its parts. One of the producers asked many years later, what was the secret of success? He said, we just caught lightning in a bottle. And I think you can say that about, you know, any successful endeavor, like a TV show or a movie or a song or a play. All of a sudden, it kind of ignites, you know. And I don't think you can reduce it in any way and say, oh, well, it was just the TV show, or, oh, it was just the writing, or it was just the singing, it was just the acting.
It was everything.
It's everything. And like I say, the whole becomes greater than the sum of its parts, and it just takes off.
Well, and when I think about it, too, you were making the first there was never a show like this before, and you were kind of making really the first music videos on television, you know, decades before MTV even came around.
Yeah, we didn't call them music videos. They were called romps.
Was that right?
and we called them the romp. And every script had a romp in it, or two sometimes. And that was to have footage to do something over the song, the new song that was going in the show that week.
Right.
And so usually it would have been a chase scene. But, you know, there's other sort of, I hate to claim, you know, I hate to claim paternity in these cases. if you look back at some of the movies, Hollywood movies of the 30s and 40s, they had music and they had dance routines. And look at the Marx Brothers. They would have video over a song.
Interesting. Interesting comparison.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so there are other examples of music, Busby Berkeley musicals. Look at that stuff. So there are other examples. And, but in terms of using a 3-minute video to promote a 3-minute song, yeah, I guess we probably were one of the first or the first to do that. But we called them romps, actually.
Romps. Yeah, no, I mean, it was marketing genius, really, to have those in the middle of shows. And it was so fun, too, because, I mean, I grew up, I was born in 67, so I discovered, the Monkees a few years later, obviously, and watched the reruns not only in syndication in the 70s, but then MTV ran them for a while, and Nick, and now they're on Antenna TV. I mean, generations have been able to discover this program. But then you had to go on tour. I mean, at some point during all this, you're doing TV, you're doing the music and recording albums, and now, hey, we're hitting the road and we're going out in concert. I mean, that was a big deal.
Well, again, as you said, that had never been even attempted before in exactly the same way. But all, there had been a little crossover. Look at Ricky Nelson, He recorded, he had songs out, but not to the level and not to the degree that the Monkees did. It was a really concerted effort, by the radios, the record company and the television company and the radio stations. But that was the plan. It had been the plan all along. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bothered to cast guys that could sing and play.
Sure, that
they would have just faked the whole thing and for whatever, a very Hollywood, sort of tradition, which was done for decades. So they obviously had in mind they wanted us to eventually get on the road. It was interesting. I had months to practice the drums. I was a guitar player, as you know, and I said, I'm a guitar player, and they said, yeah, but we have enough guitar players, so you're the drummer. And I, my attitude of going into a Hollywood television series, I was sure, great, where do I start? And then the next day I started drum lessons, kind of like similar to Circus Boy, when they said you're gonna be the Circus Boy on NBC and you're gonna ride an elephant. And I said,
And
I said, great, where do I start?
Yeah, exactly.
and I had elephant riding lessons.
Wow. Well, let's talk about your drumming style a little bit. It is so unique, and I love when you play the drums on stage.
Well, thank you. I have great fun doing it. I'm okay at what I do. I'm certainly not any kind of a session drummer. I never had to play anything that I hadn't already recorded.
Mm-hmm.
But I love playing, and I do love playing. I play a little weird, it's kind of backwards, the setup. And I played even on this, latest album we did, Good Times. And I do love playing. When we do Monkee shows, I play
you do everything.
A lot. But when I do a solo show, I don't tend to, because over the years, us singing drummers do tend to come down more often and sing up downstage, because frankly, it's like it's pretty boring to go to a concert and not be able to see the lead singer who's
sitting behind
a bunch of cymbals.
Yeah, right.
So I talked to Phil in the past, and I've talked to Ringo, and it's inevitable. If you're singing the lead, people want to see you downstage singing the lead.
And speaking of the Beatles, I mean, you got to know these guys. I mean, you guys were going along very similar paths. And at some point, you guys got to get together and hang out a little bit. Got to know each other.
Well, quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But way back from the 60s on, I mean, the thing about the Beatles is they got it. They got what the Monkees was all about.
Yeah.
That pop sort of excursion into reality versus fantasy, that whole thing. They got it. John Lennon was the first one I remember ever saying they're like the Marx Brothers, and he was so right. I mean, in fact, the Monkees was a whole lot more about the Marx Brothers than it was the Beatles. Because on the television show, for instance, we were never famous. We were never successful. Whereas if you look at Hard Day's Night or Help, which are obviously wonderful movies, the Beatles were famous. They were the Beatles, and they were successful, and they and that's what it was about. But on the Monkees show, on the television show, we never made it. We were always struggling for success. And that, I think, is, again, one of those little key elements that the producers wisely incorporated. And that's also what helped, I think, sort of resonate amongst all the kids around the U.S. and the world that were in their basements and their garages, you know, trying to be the Beatles. Because ultimately, that's what the Monkees show was about. It was about this imaginary group living in this imaginary beach house trying to be the Beatles.
Yeah.
And
great guest stars.
That's what it was about.
But it was fun, and it was light. And you know what? I got to tell you something. It surprises me that you say you were struggling from a TV show's perspective to be big on television. And yet the show, 5 decades later, still, you know, is so popular with just about every generation. You know, people love watching that show.
I think that is one of the reasons, is that it was about the struggle for success, and everybody, especially as a young teenager or early 20s, you're trying to carve out a space in the world, and that's what we were doing. We were struggling to make a living. I mean, it does beg the question of how we afforded a Malibu beach house when we never got any work.
Actor, musician, director, radio personality, you've done it all between doing the TV show and acting, between doing live concerts, between recording music. What do you enjoy the most, Mickey?
Oh, it depends entirely on the event, the gig, entirely. You know, I get attracted to a project because of the content, the music, or the acting, or the directing, or the you know, like a music. If I'm doing a Broadway musical, it's all about the content and the event. I mean, I can't say I have a preference. I mean, I know that I do love doing musicals because I started kind of late in life doing that, and I always wanted to, but I got around to it sort of late in life, and now I've done quite a few. Just a couple years ago, I did Hairspray in the West End of London, and then I've been on Broadway 2 times, and I've done national tours of a number of shows.
Grease, Comedy Is Hard.
I do love musicals, but I also love rock and roll shows. I mean, how can you not love showing up, you know, and a whole bunch of people are there singing along with you? I always kind of look at it as, you know, somebody throwing you a birthday party every night. It's it's wonderful. And when I do the Arcata, the theater, I've done it before. In fact, I recorded a live DVD there. And you know, how can you not love it? You know, so I love that. And now I'm really totally into a woodworking business with my daughter. I love doing that.
Yeah, Georgia. Yeah, you're doing that too.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Hairspray. You done Grease. You did a recent play, Comedy Is Hard. Are you looking to do another play? Do you want to keep it? You want to mix it up a little bit so you're having some fun?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm talking about it to people all the time. Last year was tough. I had a couple of offers. I had an offer to do a big national tour of a famous show. But I couldn't. I mean, I was on the road.
Yeah, 66 concerts.
7 friggin' months.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
It was like, you know, I didn't unpack for I finally unpacked last week.
No, man. No, I believe it. 66 concerts. I was looking at this in 4 different countries and all promoting the new album as well. And your last solo album was a little bit Broadway, a little bit rock and roll. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was asked by a producer in New York if I wanted to do a cabaret gig at a very famous cabaret, New York cabaret place called 54 Below, and it's below the old Studio 54, and it's a real high-end sort of cabaret dinner thing that a lot of Broadway people do. I, and frankly, I was scared if you using, if you don't mind the term, scared shitless, because that's it's really intimate, you know, and it's no big lights and, mm-hmm. and five piece band and stuff. It's a piano and a, you know, acoustic, not quite, you know, kind of an acoustic jazzy cabaret kind of thing. And I was, you know, concerned, but I started rehearsing and working up some tunes and besides Monkey Tunes. And and it was, and he said, well, and we're going to record it, and so you have a new CD. And I said, okay, let's go for it. You know, I kind of went out on a limb and, you know, challenged myself. And told stories. It's very story oriented. It's not completely a one man show, but it has that sort of vibe to it. And I did it, and we sold it out. And they asked me back, and I did it again. And now they've asked me back again. I'm doing it in the March.
This sounds like a great show to bring to Vegas because there are so many intimate venues there. That just this sounds like a great show to go see. What about Vegas? Is that something that's crossed your mind?
Oh, of course. Absolutely. Yeah. I love playing Vegas. I don't gamble, so it's for me, it's a great town.
Yeah, me neither. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, everything's really cheap.
Yeah, very cheap.
It's a great... I love Vegas. I just there a little while ago. It is a great town. And, yeah, I would love to. Like I said, the whole last year, I was just incommunicado. Yeah. I was out of the...
Sure.
You know, we were doing huge concerts and stuff, but it's going to slow down a bit. In this first few months of the year, because we're kind of gearing up for the 67 Summer of Love. I'm doing a show along with my dear friend Mark Lindsay and the Fab Four, and I'm sure we'll be coming your way.
Cool.
Called 50 Summers of Love that we're booking now for summer and fall to celebrate the Summer of Love in 67. It's going to be a great show. And and then I'm doing these solo shows, like, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Coming in with my sister. She's an incredible singer.
Yeah, that's cool.
And multimedia. It's a lot of multimedia stuff going on, and photos and video and stuff from my life.
Unlike your first round of concerts with Screaming Teens, you now have this multi-generational fan base. They have introduced the Monkees to their kids and grandkids. They've introduced your music. And these people have embraced you. I told you, it was my kid's first concert coming to see the Monkees. How does that make you feel when you see these multi-generations
well,
at a concert?
I mean, you know, I just blessed. I think that's the only word I can use. I just feel blessed. 50 years, five decades of, you know, now we have... We easily have three generations of fans in the audience. The original fans, of course, the 86 reunion fans, 90s reunion fans, and then little kids. I mean, that now, when I do I'm a Believer, I tell the little kids, don't forget I did this before Shrek.
That's right. I forgot about that. That's right.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's the only way I can describe it. I just feel blessed.
Well, you can see Mickey and Mike Nesmith in concert as the Monkees present the Mike and Mickey Show Thursday, June 14th. And for tickets, visit CopernicusCenter.org. Thanks again for joining us. Look forward to seeing you in Chicago, Mickey.
Thanks for a great interview.
And have fun when you come to town.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Fermilab.
Fermilab. Have fun there. Thanks a lot, pal. Appreciate it.
Bye.
All right, much more ahead on 720 WGN.
Hey, hey, we're the Monkees. And people say we monkey around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We go where we want to, do what we like to do. We don't have time to get restless. There's always something new. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees. And people say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing to put anybody down. We're just trying to be friendly. Come and watch us sing and play. We're the young generation, and we've got something to say. Oh.